The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you feel that if Jesus was really an historical person, there should be ancient history outside the New Testament that talks about him. Well, my friend, there is. And some of you will recall that a few weeks ago on this program, we began a discussion about the testimony of Jesus outside the New Testament. Now, I had a few guests the past few weeks, so I had to kind of leapfrog a little bit before I could continue the discussion right away. But today I should get a chance to conclude this interesting discussion later on in the program. But first, some news analysis, because there's an awful lot going on. Now, this one's about 2 weeks old, actually, but still very big. Once again, there is horrific violence at the hands of a Muslim. And once again, we are told that it is not an act of terrorism, not really. Once again, we are listening to self-righteous, sanctimonious lectures which insist Islam really has nothing to do with this because it's actually a very peaceful religion. It is time for our nation to confront this politically correct drivel and put it out in the pasture where it belongs. According to police in Moore, Oklahoma, Alton Nolan, after being fired from a food processing plant, attacked and killed another employee, Colleen Hufford. But apparently, killing the poor woman was not enough. He also cut her head off with a knife. After this, he attacked another co-worker, Tracy Johnson. He did not succeed in killing the second woman because he was shot by Mark Vaughn, a reserve deputy from the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Department. Conveniently, Mr. Vaughn was also the chief operating officer of Vaughn Foods, which explains how he was on the scene. Now, the eerie coincidence of a beheading instantly brings to mind two Americans who were beheaded in the name of Islam by ISIS, along with an English and French citizen. Gun control activists must be in a tizzy over this. Jumpin' Jiminy, how do we interpret this one? A gun coming to the rescue of a woman whose life was in danger by a weapon other than a gun? And we don't have a lot of knife control organizations. Well, at least questions about the motive of the crime still leave plenty of room for liberal talking points. At first, the incident was being described accurately. Go figure. Local police seemed to simply call things as they saw them, pointing out that Nolan had been trying to convert his fellow workers to Islam. Everything changed when the federal government got involved. They were going to report it to the federal government because it looked like terrorism. I was expecting this. I said this to my friends. It won't look like terrorism anymore. When the FBI under Obama gets involved, I knew it would happen. Like I know there's a nose on my face. Federal law enforcement officials offered a more predictable interpretation, making it clear that the FBI has not as of yet found any link to terrorism. No link to terrorism? Did we or did we not see a woman's head cut off? That is considered the signature of Islamic terrorism. Does the guy have to be a member of ISIS or Al-Qaeda to qualify? Do we have to have a badge or a secret decoder ring before calling things what they are? Ironically, these same officials informed the Washington Post that Nolan had recently converted to Islam and had a provocative Facebook page with a photo of Osama bin Laden. I'm sure it's a great comfort to Colleen Hufford's loved ones if Nolan wasn't actually connected to an honest-to-goodness terrorist organization. Her head was cut off, but we have some great news. Great news, the guy didn't belong to ISIS. What a relief. More importantly, without that connection, of course, the Obama administration will not be blamed for an act of terrorism on their watch. Nothing new here. The Obama administration is not to be blamed for anything these past 6 years. It is probably no surprise that the FBI, under the auspices of the Obama administration, would be reluctant to define this as an act of terrorism, particularly terrorism associated with Islam. After all, this is the same administration which called the Fort Hood shootings of 2009 domestic violence, even though the killer, Nidal Malik Hassan, was a Muslim who shouted Allah Akbar while shooting 13 people. Although the FBI does define terrorism as an action aimed at scaring a civilian population, it also says, and I quote, "There is no single universally accepted definition of terrorism." Well, then, if that's the case, perhaps a beheading in the name of Islam might just qualify. Besides, there may even be one or two scared people in Oklahoma after this incident. They probably don't see beheadings every day. MSNBC's Melissa Harris-Perry helped to alleviate such fears by bringing two Muslim comedians on her program, Dean Obadallah and Negan Farsad. Says Farsad in a tongue-in-cheek manner, "That's the new stereotype. Pass it around. Muslims are hilarious." Yes, indeed. A good laugh is what our country needs right now. Okay, so a woman was beheaded. That's a tragedy, of course, but for Pete's sake, let's lighten things up a little. Not that Obadallah and Farsad were there to do a stand-up routine. They actually had a serious message to convey. Namely, that it is the right-wing media who is continuing the narrative that Islam is responsible for what happened in Oklahoma. Islam? Responsible? Where, oh where, would anybody get an idea like that? If only the right-wing media could learn the nuances of the left-wing media. Harris-Perry could show them how. "It's a story that I read as a workplace violence story," she said, adding that Nolan's faith is of no more significance than what she ate for breakfast that morning. Let's see if we can add up the logic here. The murder of Colleen Hufford should be called workplace violence. Why? Because it happened in the workplace, silly. Therefore, we couldn't possibly reach a more obvious conclusion. True, with that same line of reasoning, it is just as obvious that Alton Nolan is a Muslim who tried to convert others at work and who has a picture of Osama bin Laden on his Facebook page. But alas, those details are sheer coincidence, and only a bigoted right-winger would point them out. On the other hand, perhaps we can consider an alternative interpretation. Maybe the fact that militant Muslims have declared war on the United States means we really are at war with Muslims. Not all Muslims. Not all Muslims. And for the politically correct, I'll say it one more time. Not all Muslims. Okay? Feel better now? But certainly a significant number of Muslims. Perhaps it doesn't matter if they belong to ISIS, Hamas, or any other formal organization. What matters is they are getting their marching orders from the Quran, be they organized or be they lone wolves. Titles such as ISIS are too specific. Titles such as extremists are too broad. Even the term terrorist, the few times Obama actually uses it, is too broad. We are not at war with every terrorist organization in the world, such as the IRA. We are at war with militant Islam. Our failure to properly identify the enemy is a fatal one, for our enemy has certainly identified us. A canary might comfort herself by imagining that it was not really a cat who broke into her cage. The cat will eat her anyway, losing no sleep over what he was called. We can extend the hand of peace. All our enemy will do is view it as a sign of weakness, and they'll kill us anyway.
Listen, children, to a story that was written long ago about a kingdom on a mountain and the valley folk below. On the mountain was a treasure buried deep beneath the stone, and the valley people swore they'd have it for their very own. Go ahead and hit your neighbor, go ahead and cheat your friend, do it in the name of heaven, justified in the end. There won't be any troubles blowing, come the judge.
which they kill, came an answer from the kingdom. With our brothers we will share all the secrets of our mountain, all the riches buried there. On earth was all it said.
Go ahead and hate your neighbor. Go ahead and cheat a friend. Do it in the name of heaven. You can justify it in the end. There won't be any trumpets blowing come the judgment day on the bloody morning.
This is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. You're going to love this one. The FBI wants help from the American citizens in identifying terrorists. Well, far be it from me to not cooperate with the FBI. Okay, guys, check out that Oklahoma beheading in the name of Islam. Stop calling it a domestic violence. Is that a nice hot tip for you? Of course, the Oklahoma beheading is not the only Muslim murder in the news. Another series of murders from a few years ago that the Defense Department, under our commander-in-chief, or as some call him, our campaigner-in-chief, Barack Obama, labeled workplace violence, that's back in the news. Convicted Fort Hood killer Nadel Hassan, and I did refer back to him before the break, he wrote a letter very recently to Pope Francis, of all people, talking positively about jihad and going out of his way to identify himself with radicalism. So, see, it doesn't matter how Obama identifies. Listen to how he's identifying himself. Now, this is not the first time since the 2009 shooting spree that Hassan has described himself as a soldier of Allah. And I'm quoting him. At Hassan's request, his attorney, John Galligan, mailed a 6-page handwritten letter to the Vatican. A copy of the letter was given to Fox News. It's called A Warning to Pope Francis, Members of the Vatican, and Other Religious Leaders Around the World. In this correspondence, Hassan quotes from the Quran several times and offers bits of advice to believers. In one section entitled Jihad, Hassan praises the willingness to fight for Almighty Allah. He also says fighters have a greater rank in the eyes of Allah than believers who don't fight. The Fort Hood shooting was not enough to be called an act of terrorism, even though he shouted Allah Akbar while gunning down his victims. At the moment, Hassan is on death row, but his victims, army soldiers, do not even qualify for the Purple Heart. Because supposedly this workplace incident has nothing to do with any real war with militant Islam. Well, will this recent letter to the Pope, in which Hassan openly declares himself a soldier of Islam, contribute toward the Obama administration rethinking the Fort Hood incident? Will the soldiers who died at the hands of a self-confessed jihadist finally receive the Purple Hearts that they deserve? Before venturing to answer, keep in mind the current track record of our president. When it comes to telling the truth, nobody's ever going to confuse this guy for George Washington. This is the same man who said that if you like your doctor and healthcare provider, you can keep them. This is also the same man who said that the 2012 attack against Americans in Benghazi was not an organized terrorist killing, but rather spontaneous violence as a result of a video. And when asked if the IRS is guilty of any corruption regarding the whole Lois Lerner nonprofit fiasco, he said there was not even a smidgen of evidence, not even a smidgen, even though supposedly the investigation was still going on. So how would he have known that? And why did Lois Lerner need to plead the fifth? Declaring Fort Hood's shooting to be Islamic terror would mean that an act of terrorism happened in America under Obama's watch. Now, hold on to your seat, because I'm going to defend Obama for a moment. Never thought you'd live to see the day, did you? Admitting as much, admitting that it was an act of terrorism, even on his watch, would not mean the president is personally culpable, because it's impossible to stop every single act of terror. But Obama doesn't seem to like admitting things, even when he's not personally at fault. Not if it contradicts any of his narratives. Not if it contradicts any of his talking points, such as having Al-Qaeda on the run. In this vein, there is some responsibility. By not calling things as they are, he is making it difficult to wage a war that we are a part of, whether we like it or not. To anyone interested in actual facts, this letter settles once and for all what was already obvious to any thinking person. The Fort Hood attack was terrorism in the name of radical Islam. But don't bet money on the Obama administration changing its story. You'd do better against a professional poker table in Las Vegas. Speaking of Obama, confused about the conflicting and muddy statements made by President Obama regarding the ISIS threat? Well, be of good cheer. We have gathered the greatest team of diplomats, politicians, and interpreters to read between the lines and decipher our president's words. Here at last is a clear testimony of his sturdy, uncompromising position regarding the current Middle East crisis. Let me make a few things clear regarding the war with ISIS. First of all, this is not really a war. And second of all, they are not really ISIS, because that abbreviation includes the words Islamic State. These guys are not a state. Neither are they Islamic. Oh, sure, they claim to be Muslims, but what do they know? My job as president includes correct interpretation. It is not my place to let people speak for themselves. That would be far too simplistic. Remember, I have a reputation for being nuanced. We must take a nuanced view of this war with self-confessed Muslims, and that means coming to the conclusion that we are not at war and they are not Muslims. How can they be? As I said in my 2009 Magical Mystery Apology Tour, Islam is a beautiful, peaceful religion which preaches brotherhood and spreads goodwill around the world. I'll grant you that it may not always look that way, especially when we see Americans beheaded and all, but a few bad apples don't spoil the whole bunch. Look at the other side. Look how many Muslim friends we have in places such as Egypt or Saudi Arabia. Okay, so they also burn down churches in Egypt, and Bibles are forbidden in Saudi Arabia. What are you, some kind of pessimist? You always have to concentrate on the negative? Next, you'll be telling me about Palestinian schools teaching Jews are evil and Jews should be exterminated, or that homosexuals are executed in countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, Mauritania, Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen. Well, that's true, but it's very wrong of you to point it out. Or maybe you'll want to remind me again about how the Taliban treated women by slicing off the tops of their thumbs if they wore nail polish. My friends, I'm not condoning such actions, but you must remember there were moderate Taliban too. Some only sliced off half of the woman's upper thumb. Anyway, we are not at war. We may be bombing them, but we are not at war because we are saying that we are not at war. Besides, how can it be a war if there are no boots on the ground? True, we have special forces such as the CIA on the ground, but a lot of them don't wear boots. They just wear regular shoes. Now, I don't want you to worry that just because we aren't at war, that means ISIS will not be stopped. Of course they'll be stopped, but they are not an immediate threat. If they were, we would concern ourselves more with the many terrorists who are talking about coming through our southern borders. But those borders don't concern me. They are well guarded. Look how fast the Mexican government captured a U.S. Marine who accidentally made a wrong turn into Mexico. By the way, if you're wondering why I didn't get him out with one phone call to the president of Mexico, well, sure, that would have been the quick, easy thing to do. But remember, we cannot be simple. We must be nuanced. Only a nuanced, measured response toward non-Americans will keep us safe. Every time we get aggressive militarily, it just stirs the hornet's nest and creates more terrorists. I guess being aggressive also kills terrorists, but if we do that too much, people might think we are at war, and we're not at war. Haven't you been paying attention? In summary, ISIS claims to be Muslim and has declared war in the United States, but they are not Muslims, and they are not at war with the United States, because if they were, it would mean that we were at war with them, too, and our many bombs must never be mistaken for boots on the ground. By the way, George Bush is responsible for this mess in the Middle East. Had we listened to him, we would still have troops in Iraq. True, the region might be safer, but people might also think we were still at war, and at least under me, they know we are not at war. Okay, we've sliced and diced this thing to death, no pun intended. Can I go finish my golf game now? Don't look at me like that. George Bush played golf too.
Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480539. W&S Electric.
Hi, I'm Dana Wright, here to talk about Bob Siegel's book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... The title itself is an open-ended question. You fill in the rest. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but... Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? How will God judge people who never heard of Jesus? Can a scientific mind really accept miracles? These are but some of the concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book has been enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians alike. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
visit to the University of California, San Diego by outspoken conservative author David Horowitz a few years ago is getting renewed attention, and rightly so, because the story is as relevant as ever, and it ties into many other things going on in universities today. Now, this was designed to be a cordial and informative open forum at the University of California, San Diego. Instead, some shocking comments were made about Jews from a Muslim student during an exchange with Horowitz. Horowitz was invited to the campus as a guest speaker by the student club Young Americans for Freedom. During an open exchange, Horowitz asked a member of the Muslim Student Association if she supports groups such as Hamas and similar terrorist organizations. At first, she replied with a question, "Are you asking me to put myself on a cross?" Then she continued, "If I say something, I'm sure I will be arrested for reasons of homeland security." You think that might have sounded like she believed in Hamas? Anyway, at this point, the audience was still only witnessing a warm-up. The real fireworks were ignited when Horowitz offered the most pointed question of all. He said, "I'm a Jew. The head of Hezbollah has said that he hopes we will all gather in Israel so he doesn't have to hunt us down globally. For it or against it?" After a moment of silence, the student said, "For it." Now, the UCSD rabbi said her comments made many Jewish students feel uneasy. You think? Boy, this rabbi has a gift for Grand Canyon-sized understatement. The rabbi said, "It was very painful for us to hear that. We have someone telling us that they will be hunting us down wherever we are, and if we would all be in Israel, it would be easier for them. It brings a very uncomfortable situation and atmosphere on campus." Now, Horowitz himself gets accused of extreme views. He has referred to this event entitled Justice in Palestine Week as a cause linked to terrorist groups. Some say they even caught him calling the group Hitler Youth Week. If true, that would certainly be an extreme statement. But ladies and gentlemen, given the Muslim woman's answer to his question and the fact that several terrorist groups are connected to the Palestinian cause, it might be time to remind ourselves that an extreme view might also be a true view. It might be the truth, an outrageous truth perhaps, but truth nevertheless. The Muslim student has since walked her comment back. She apologized, claiming she didn't accurately hear the question. She said, "Had I understood the nature of the question, I would never have responded the way that I did by providing an answer that misrepresented my beliefs." Yeah, she probably thought Horowitz was asking if she loved Jews and wanted to join hands with them around a campfire and guitar to sing about world peace. I can understand how she might have heard the question that way. Or in as much as she had already put it on record moments before that she does not renounce Hamas, another organization which calls for the death of Jews. Maybe she did hear the question and a quick, unguarded moment revealed her heart. Maybe she regrets the comment only because of the bad publicity. Well, a UCSD spokesperson tried to get rid of the bad publicity. He said, "At UCSD, we strongly condemn any suggestion that violence, especially genocidal violence, is a legitimate political tool. We firmly believe that this was one student's opinion, and it's not representative of the opinions of the majority of our student body." Okay, those are great sounding words. Let's hope they're followed up by action. Anti-Semitism is on the rise today on college campuses all over the country. In April of this year, anti-Israeli student activists at the University of Michigan shouted death threats at Jewish student council members using words such as "dirty Jew" and "kike." At University of California, Berkeley, a Jewish girl holding an "Israel Wants Peace" sign was deliberately hit with a shopping cart pushed her direction by the head of Students for Justice in Palestine. At Harvard University, the Palestine Security Committee decided to have fun with Jewish students by placing fake eviction notices on their dorm room doors. At Northeastern University in Boston, Students for Justice in Palestine desecrated a menorah and disrupted several Jewish events. In the fall of 2003, San Francisco State University witnessed an all-day event sponsored by the General Union of Palestine Students. This one was especially created. Participants were invited to make posters and t-shirts saying, "My heroes have always killed colonizers." The colonizers, of course, were Jews. Somehow the fact that Jews have been living in the Holy Land since ancient times was conspicuously ignored. The immediate aftermath of these events was not followed up with any official response on the part of the universities. Although most professors would not endorse such vandalism and would deny being anti-Semites, many of their teachings fuel the fire for Jew hatred by relaying historical revision about Israel, inaccurate historical revision. UCSD communications professor Gary Fields has written a book entitled Dispossession, which takes on the Palestinian cause and accuses Israel of occupying land it should not have. He also said in an article for the San Diego Union that Israel has a time-honored strategy of disinformation. David Klein, a California State University Northridge math professor, put up web pages on the university's survey calling for a boycott of Israel. Now, what that has to do with teaching math is anybody's guess. David Lloyd, a professor of English at University of California, Riverside, has put together a campus event featuring Omar Barghouti, and if I didn't pronounce his name right, I just don't care. Featuring Omar Barghouti, who has accused Israeli soldiers of hunting children and accused America Jews and Israeli sympathizers of both controlling the media and buying and paying for the allegiance of Congress. You know, that Jewish conspiracy talk, the kind of stuff Hitler did. Lloyd offered course credit to any of his students who attended Barghouti's speech. At NYU, Professor Lisa Duggan organized a conference that provided a platform for 21 anti-Israel activists to call for Israel's elimination. In general today, many professors talk as if Israel exists illegally, even though her statehood was legally voted upon by the United Nations. They talk as if Palestinians are merely after their own state, when in fact they turned down a state of their own in 1947 after the same United Nations voted to partition land between Jews and Arabs. They talk as if Israel has occupied Palestine, when in fact the occupied territory was expansion taken from countries who had openly sworn to annihilate Israel and instead were stopped with a preemptive attack during the Six-Day War of 1967. Finally, they talk as if today's acts of terrorism in the name of Islam are due to both Israeli and American policy, when in fact the Quran commands such jihad, and it commands it in places such as Surah 9. Prophet, make war with the unbelievers and the hypocrites and deal rigorously with them. Hell shall be their home, an evil fate. They swear by God that they said nothing, yet they uttered the word of unbelief and renounced Islam after embracing it. It is high time for some moral clarity. The problem Middle East Muslim countries have with Israel is that Israel is not a Muslim country. That statement is extreme. That statement is also true. Well, if you'd like to weigh in on any of this, you can reach me through Facebook, Twitter, or directly questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel.net. And we'll get to some of your comments when we return. Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching of nationally famous speaker, Pastor Jim Garlow. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church. Sunday morning services at 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock a.m. Reading some comments coming through Facebook or directly, questions at bobsiegel.net regarding today's monologues. And, of course, in my online column, Forbidden Table Talk, there are written versions of these monologues. Bob Price is an atheist friend. He and I have debated, but we're the best of friends. And he's also a fellow conservative. We agree politically. We just don't agree on whether or not God exists. But regarding today's monologue about the Oklahoma beheading, Bob says, terrific badge or decoder ring. Hilarious. The reason the FBI can't be sure Nolan is a Muslim jihadi and not just an individual maniac is that there is really no difference. Maureen says, I kept hearing the same. No proof that it was an act of terrorism after he cut off her head and was trying to convert people to Islam. Some excellent points in your article again. Valia writes, well said. Thank you. Fran says, I feel so outraged over this and so incredibly ashamed of those elected officials who are pulling the government's strings in outrageous decisions. I mean, there are real victims involved, families whose lives have been turned upside down, children and grandchildren who will forever have a brutal and senseless slang in their memories. Yet our government is more concerned about correct wording of an obvious terrorist attack and murder. Now, Jim disagrees. He says, Nolan's religious beliefs may have played a role here, but I'm not convinced that that makes this terrorism. How exactly are you defining the word? For this to be terrorism, there has to be a bigger political motive. The Fort Hood shooter may qualify, but Nolan? Where's the evidence of that? To be motivated by religion isn't enough for a killing to be terrorism. Every crazy who kills because of the angelic voices in his head, and there have been a few, would be a terrorist. We run into similar problems in defining hate crimes. If an anti-Semitic Christian kills a Jew, is that a regular murder, a hate crime, or an act of terrorism? It seems to depend on whether he killed the Jew for his watch, his religion, or to start a pogrom. The word Holocaust gets overused and loses its power. When feminists argue that an unwanted look is sexual assault becomes less awful, not more. If we're going to call this terrorism, we should make sure the word fits like a glove. Well, Jim, I appreciate the idea that you don't want words to get misused and watered down. But as my article indicated, the FBI also said there is no single universal definition of terrorism, be that as it may. A beheading in the name of Islam is meant to make a statement, and that fear thus received can be viewed as terrorism. But my article and monologue was more concerned with those who will not associate this with militant Islam. Some seem to suggest that we are only at war with radical Muslims who want to kill us if they are part of an actual terrorist organization. There can be less affiliated soldiers in the cause. This is from Peter in Maine regarding last week's show in which Kevin Conover and I interviewed a representative of CARE. He said, Bob, I appreciate your compassion for believers and skeptics like me. Like, I am listening to your recorded program, and I have to say, one kind of person I find hard to give any quarter to are revisionists, whether they are modern-day Muslims or Joseph Smith. Either you believe or you do not. It seems slimy to me for people to try to wiggle out of the objections to any religious doctrine. This is from Wayne, who thought our guest last week from CARE offered some weak arguments and did some tap dancing when he couldn't answer our arguments. He says, good show, Bob. Some tap dancing going on, especially as the show progressed. At times, it seemed like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. I hope you have him on again and explore some more. It seemed pretty weak about the Bible being incorrect at the time of Muhammad. And this is from Chris, who listens to us in Texas. Bob, I listened to your radio show. He never really addressed the issue with divinity of Jesus, nor about Muhammad versus about lying. When you pointed out something embarrassing, he just declared what the audience wanted to hear, regardless of what the Quran said. Now, this is from Brian in Texas also, but he's talking about our interview from a few weeks back with a Buddhist nun. He says, finally caught up with school enough to listen to that Buddhist show you did with Kevin. Have to be up early on Mondays now, so I can't stay up to listen live. Reactions. The philosophy behind her karma was almost a contradiction. She said that karma exists from past lives, even not the most recent, meaning that reincarnation was, I guess, inevitable. We will be back again someday to pay for our wrongdoings. Weird. How the karma she perceived to be the cause or the controlling factor of bad circumstances, but I think she said the goal of Buddhists are to learn to control the mind and the karma. If there is no definite God to Buddhists, but a mysterious being pushing the karma, how and why would they think they could control it? I do believe that if we control our actions, then we can have control of reactions to or from our initiations. But honestly, beyond that, it's not in our job description to be able to control much more. We believe in God who does have the ability to control. Think that's it. Thank you for the show. Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts, Brian. It's always good to hear from you. Now, regarding what we talked about today, anti-Semitism on college campuses, You're going to love this one. Mike says, most of the people in the world don't like Israel at all. Just think about it. What has Israel done to make people think that way? Maybe nothing, Mike. People think stupid, untrue things all the time without needing any help. But Mike continues, you can't blame all these highly intellectual American profs without asking why they do it. Everybody knows that Israel kills all the innocent children and women with their highly developed guns. That should not happen. Okay, Mike, so let me see if I'm following. The majority is automatically right? Your argument that Israel does evil things is that most of the world feels that way, therefore it must be true. Throughout history, my friend, the majority has often been wrong. The majority believed in slavery at one time, too. Now, I have challenged the conventional wisdom of Israel with facts, not by taking a vote. And Israel does not deliberately kill innocent women and children with their guns. Where are you getting this tripe? But David's comment is even worse. He says, look at what some Israeli politicians have been calling for. Mass rape of Palestinian women, genocide, ethnic cleansing, etc. And Israel is not under any existential threat like the Palestinians are. Oh, no. The Palestinians just say Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth, that all Jews should be exterminated. They don't recognize their right to exist. But no, Israel's not under any threat. And bordering countries like Syria and Egypt, they're not a threat to Israel either. And what did you say, David? Israeli politicians are calling for the mass rape of Palestinian women and children? You have no idea what you're talking about. You're popping off at the mouth, and you haven't got a clue what you're talking about. And ladies and gentlemen, if I sound angry, it's because I am. I want to sound angry right now. I made a choice to read this comment and respond because I want you to know what's out there. And as I respond to what's out there, I want to present a sense of outrage. I'm doing this deliberately because evil flourishes for two reasons. People are either too cowardly to confront it or too stupid to confront it. I wish some people would activate their brains before activating their mouths. As for those who simply hate Israel, they have no facts. Nip, zip, zada, nada. Only the propaganda of news organizations like Al Jazeera's and other anti-Semitic pigs. And if there's one thing I'm getting sick and tired of, it's anti-Semitic pigs. And I say that as a Christian. Let me repeat it for those of you who think Christians are supposed to do nothing but smile and say, praise the Lord. Let me be as clear as I can be. I am sick and tired of anti-Semitic pigs. I say that before God, fully aware that I will someday stand before his throne and answer for every word. Well, a couple of weeks ago, we dealt with the question of Jesus in ancient history outside of the New Testament. So we'll go ahead and continue that discussion when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. Bobsiegel.net.
the questions I get a lot is, how come historians that actually lived at the same time of Jesus don't write about him? And I began this discussion a couple of weeks ago, and you can go to my website if you want to hear part one, because I've already mentioned several of these historians. One of them is, my friend, is historians don't write about something until after it makes world news or has a significant impact on a specific country. That's why we call it history. But the Roman historian Tacitus, who lived between 56 to 117 AD, approximately, was certainly living very close to the time of Christ. Now, when would a country like Rome first take interest in a movement called Christianity? Only when it affects Rome. If it starts making police news, if there are riots out on the street, that's when we would first expect the Romans to start talking about Christianity, and that's just exactly what happened. Because at the time of Emperor Nero, many of the districts of Rome were burned down, and Nero blamed Christians. So looking into this later, we had this fellow who was very reputed as being a very careful historian. He would have gone and checked the actual records of Pontius Pilate, and I mentioned them before. They were actually on file in the imperial archives. And he writes about Christianity, and it's very clear that he's not a Christian because he's writing some things about Christianity in a derogatory way. But he's verifying the existence of Christ. Look at what he says, Tacitus. Their originator, Christ, had been executed in Tiberius's reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. But in spite of this temporary setback, the deadly superstition had broken out afresh, not only in Judea, where the mischief had started, but even in Rome. All degraded and shameful practices collect and flourish in the capital. I do want to point out, going back to our last discussion, that here's an ancient writer verifying that there was this place called Judea, which means Jews were living there. It's not that they all came from Europe and stole this land from the indigenous Palestinians. So here's somebody who, you know, here it is verified in ancient history in one of many, many places. But anyway, he's talking here about Christ. And in a very derogatory way, he's calling Christianity a superstition. But notice what he says here. He's saying the death of Christ stopped the superstition. Well, superstition means you're talking about something supernatural. Well, if the death of Christ stopped the supernatural, or the discussion of the supernatural, as he would call it, what would it take for the superstition to break out afresh, as he says? Evidently, he's talking about the resurrection. Does he personally believe in the resurrection? Apparently not. But here is a historian at least reporting that there was a rumor that Jesus had risen from the dead. Isn't that interesting? Now, this is from a Roman governor. He's called Pliny the Younger. This comes from his letters from Bithynia. Bithynia is in the area that we would today call Turkey. These letters date approximately 112 AD. So again, very close to the time of Christ. And in about 110, Emperor Trajan sent Pliny, an experienced administrator, as governor of the disorderly province of Bithynia. He sent them on a mission and to watch over that area. A few years later, Pliny wrote the emperor seeking advice about how to deal with Christians. There was an unsigned paper giving the names of many Christians who were viewed as traitors to the Roman emperor, mostly because they wouldn't proclaim the emperor to be God. And anyway, they were imprisoned. He wanted advice on how to conduct the trial. What punishments were appropriate? Should the young be punished like the old? Would renunciation of Jesus earn a pardon? If they renounced him, would they let him go? And the emperor did tell him if they renounced Jesus, let him go. Give him three times to renounce him. Now, I'm not reading his whole letter, but I'm going to quote some of it and then refer to some other things that are in the same letter. This is from Pliny talking about Christians. They maintained, however, that the amount of their fault or error had been this, that it was their habit on a fixed day to assemble before daylight and recite by turns a form of words to Christ as God, and that they bound themselves with an oath not for any crime, but not to commit theft or robbery or adultery, not to break their word, and not to deny a deposit when demanded. After this was done, their custom was to depart and to meet again to take food, but ordinary and harmless food. Now, this is the earliest surviving non-Christian description of what Christians believed and how they lived. And we learn a couple of things from this. Some of the prisoners whom he threatened said that they'd been Christians for 20 years. That's from a part of the letter I didn't read to you. We conclude that there must have been Christians at least by the late 80s of the first century, maybe earlier. In fact, in the New Testament, Peter's first letter written in the early 60s is addressed to Christians in Bithynia, among others, thus confirming what we know from Pliny. And it says here that Christians were already worshiping Jesus. A lot of times people say, oh, this idea of calling Jesus God, that was invented years ago. How do I know that? I read that in the Da Vinci Code. Emperor Constantine, look, how close this is to the time of Jesus. Christians are already worshiping Jesus as God. And it confirms that early Christians sometimes destroyed the business side of older religions. That's another thing from part of the letter we didn't read. And that confirms the book of Acts, when there were people that were building these statues to idols and they didn't want people becoming Christians because they'd be out of business. And it confirms that Christians met for worship on a fixed day of the week. Now here's another piece of literature from a fellow called Lucian of Samostata. We date this about AD 120 to 180. Samostati also is in what we would today call Turkey. This guy was a satirist. He didn't like Christians. He scorned them. I'm so glad these people that didn't like Christians and argue against them wrote. They have no idea what a favor they were doing for us historically, because they're proving that Christians just didn't make this stuff up, that Jesus really exists. But anyway, he says, the Christians worship a man. Again, they're talking about Jesus being worshipped. The Christians worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced this new cult and was crucified on that account. You see, these misguided creatures start with the general conviction that they are immortal for all time, which explains their contempt for death and self-devotion. Their lawgiver taught that they are all brothers from the moment that they are converted and deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live after his laws. All this they take on faith. Wow, we've learned a bundle from this one. Christ was worshipped as God, according to Lucian of Samostata. Christ was the founder of Christianity. Christ was crucified. Christians believe in immortality. Here's another one. You want another one? I got another one for you. Maribar Cyprian. This was a letter written sometime between 73 and 200 AD. It was written in Latin. Now, we have no information about this author beyond what was found in this letter. If we hadn't found out this letter, we'd never know anything about him. He talks as if he witnessed his own city ruined. He himself was taken captive by the Romans for a while. He describes the misery of his friends and companions belonging to that same city of Lucian, Samostata. And he was taken by the Romans in the reign of Vespasian. That's the city, at least, was taken in the reign of Vespasian, AD 72. Now, about 23 years later, there was persecution in the city under Domitian, about AD 95. So there's a range of possibilities about the time he's talking about. But listen to what this guy says. What are we to say about the what are we to say when the wise are forcibly dragged by the hands of tyrants and their wisdom is deprived of its freedom by slander and they are plundered for their superior intelligence without the opportunity of making a defense? They are not wholly to be pitied. What advantage did the Athenians gain from putting Socrates to death? Famine and plague came upon them as a judgment of their crime. What advantage did the men of Samos gain from burning Pythagoras? In a moment their land was covered with sand. What advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? It was just after that that their kingdom was abolished. God justly avenged these three wise men. The Athenians died of hunger. The Samaeans were overwhelmed by the sea. The Jews, ruined and driven from their land, live in complete dispersion. But Socrates did not die. He lived on in the teaching of Plato. Pythagoras did not die. He lived on in the statue of Hera. Nor did the wise king die. He lived on in the teaching which he had given. Now, we know this guy wasn't a Christian because, of course, if he was a Christian, he would have said that Jesus lived on by being resurrected from the dead. He wouldn't talk about Jesus just living on in his teaching. Now, there was a fellow named Thallus, I meant to say, and he wrote about 50 AD, middle of the first century. He writes against Christians, but he acknowledges that at the time of Christ's crucifixion, it suddenly went dark. He tries to explain it away as not being a miracle by saying that there was an eclipse. Again, thank you, guys. Thank you, skeptics from 2,000 years ago. You have no idea how much you're verifying this. I want to thank you personally, Thallus, for telling us that it did get dark when Jesus was crucified, just like the Bible says. We'll see you next week.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.